Have you ever had a narrow escape? A friend of mine did recently. He was on business in London and was returning in the evening to his hometown of Nottingham. He saw from his watch that he was in good time to catch an 8 o'clock train from St Pancras. He'd have 20 minutes in hand, he calculated. Unfortunately, by some inexplicable chance, this normal nimble-footed young fellow proceeded to put his foot down a drain in Westminster. Sprained his ankle so badly he could barely walk. He had been intending to catch the London Underground across the city to get to St Pancras, but he was limping so badly he decided he'd have to abandon that intention and take a taxi instead, something he would never normally do. If he had taken the Underground, then he would have been ascending the escalators at King's Cross just around 7:40 p.m. that night. The night and the time when those escalators burst into such a lethal inferno. As it was, his taxi deposited him at street level outside King's Cross to witness the flame and smoke issuing from the staircases and to see the scenes of havoc and death scattered on the pavement. It was, as he himself said, a very close shave. He's never been more thankful for a sprained ankle in his life, I don't think. Of course, the sceptical will put that all down to a lucky coincidence, won't they? But my friend's a Christian. He and his family are quite convinced it was a singular act of divine protection. The Lord knows how to rescue his own people from trials, says Peter in the New Testament. And this morning we're going to study the classic biblical illustration of that rescuing providence that God exercises towards his own. The narrowest of all narrow escapes. The closest of all close shaves. The story of Lot. And how he got out of an inferno that killed not just a few tens of people, but in all likelihood, a few tens of thousands of people. That tale begins in the chapters of Genesis that we were looking at last week. Those of you who are here, I hope, will recall that Abraham, Lot's uncle, had been called by God to leave his urban environment of his youth in Ur and Haran in Mesopotamia, and live instead a semi-nomadic lifestyle in the land of Canaan. In addition to Sarah, his wife, he took his nephew Lot along with him. Whether that was a good idea or not, we discussed last week. But in any case, he took him. And as time went on, we saw last week, the two men grew apart. It wasn't that Lot was a bad sort. On the contrary, he shared Abraham's faith and the moral conscience that went with it. The Bible itself calls Lot a righteous man. But Lot never really embraced the pilgrimage which Abraham had committed his life to. He didn't relish marching around the sparsely populated, semi-populated deserts of the Near East with just his family for company. His spirit hankered for the city life he'd known in his youth. So when circumstances gave him the opportunity to split with Abraham and go his own way, he seized it with both hands. "I'll go and live in the plain of Jordan," he said. "It's more fertile there. There are more people there. There are cities there. The cities of Sodom and Gomorrah." Chapter 13, verse 12, you may remember, summarizes the arrangement he and his uncle came to. The two men parted company. Abraham lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. It sounded an innocent enough decision on Lot's part, but even at this early stage, the narrator does make sure we detect the element of spiritual weakness that was implicit in it. For if you notice, he goes on to observe in verse 13 of that same chapter, "Now the men of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord." I'm sure Lot must have known the city's reputation for corruption. I guess he just felt that he was sufficiently morally superior not to be compromised by it. "I can keep my nose clean in the big city," he said. "And I should be so much more safe and secure there than out in the wilderness with my uncle." But of course that's where he was wrong. Sodom may have felt more secure. In fact, it was just about the most dangerous place anybody could choose to live at that particular moment in time, as events would quickly prove. Abraham is the first to realize it. God tells him in this private conversation they have that we read together just a moment ago. In verse 20, the Lord says to Abraham, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sins so grievous that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will know. So the narrator, as it were, sets up two cameras for us in chapters 18 and 19. One is stationed in Mamre, where Abraham was, in Canaan, where he's holding conversation with God about the fate of Sodom. The other camera is stationed in Sodom itself, seeing what happens to Lot and the city there. And that's how we'll divide our study this morning, looking first at chapter 18, with Abraham's prayer, and then secondly at chapter 19, at Lot's escape, and to see what lessons we can profitably learn from these two chapters together. Let's start then with Abraham's prayer. Verse 16 again of chapter 18. Abraham walked along with them to see them on their way, and the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Now it may be that some of us here are tempted to be a bit skeptical about the whole idea of this conversation between Abraham and the Lord in some kind of human shape. After all, visitations from angels and visions of God are the stuff of myth and legend, you may say, not serious history. Well, you're entitled to your opinion, of course, about that, but I would remind you that in just a few weeks' time we're going to be celebrating Christmas, celebrating the central event upon which the whole of our Christian faith hinges. An event, remember, which involved God not just coming in the outward likeness of a man, but actually taking up human flesh and blood himself through conception and birth from a woman. If we find the anthropomorphism of Genesis 18 difficult to swallow, then what on earth are we going to do with the incarnation of which John was speaking in his gospel in that earlier reading we had? The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. No, what we've got to remember, what we've got to realize, is that the whole Bible is about a God who wants to reveal himself to us human beings in ways we can understand. If he didn't accommodate himself to our limitations, we would never have any communication with him at all. If you're skeptical at Genesis 18, well, what sort of encounter between God and Abraham could you find credible? See, the whole point of this chapter is that God is wanting to relate personally to Abraham. That's the thing you must have in mind as you read the whole prayer. God is accommodating himself to Abraham in his limitations of understanding and in his humanness, and wanting to encourage Abraham to talk to him. Not just to talk to Abraham, but have Abraham converse with him. He wants him, in other words, to pray. He's teaching Abraham what prayer is all about. And bearing that in mind, what could be more reasonable than that he should choose to appear to Abraham in his very personal way, to disarm Abraham's fears, to encourage him in one-to-one conversation? Notice the soliloquy in which God engages as he turns over in his mind whether indeed he ought to reveal this dreadful plan he had for Sodom and Gomorrah to Abraham or not. Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? He asked. I find a rather touching intimacy in that question. It almost seems as if God feels obliged by his special relationship with this man not to keep him in the dark about the fate of his nephew's city. Indeed, he goes on to allow Abraham to engage in a verbal exchange with him, which some have said is not unlike the kind of marketplace bargaining that Abraham must have grown used to in his days as a merchant. Back in verse 23. Will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you sweep it away and not spare the place? And when he's given an assurance that God will indeed spare the place for the sake of 50, he knocks him down, doesn't he? First to 45, then to 40, then to 30, then to 20, finally to 10. I think the similarity to a Dutch auction mustn't be pressed too far. Notice, for a start, the caution and reverence with which Abraham comes to God on every occasion in which he speaks, like in verse 27. Now that I've been so bold as to speak to the Lord, though I am nothing but dust and ashes, Oh, again in verse 30. May the Lord not be angry, but let me speak. I don't think that is the language of a customer dealing with a shopkeeper. It's much closer, it seems to me, to the kind of deferential respect that a petitioner would use before a king. Abraham isn't haggling with God here. He is praying. The sovereignty of God is very much in his mind as he speaks. And in that connection, I think it's significant that it is God himself who seems to call a halt to the negotiations in verse 32. 10 writers will suffice, he says, but he doesn't permit any further appeal below that number. The Lord finished speaking with Abraham, and he left. Nevertheless, it is a most remarkable conversation. What are we to make of it? Can we seriously imagine that God was ignorant of how many righteous people there were in Sodom? He needed to go and have a look? Was he in any real doubt about the inevitability of his intended judgment on the city? Surely we can't really think that, can we? No. The only explanation for this remarkable exchange has to be that it took place for the sake of that special relationship that existed between Abraham and God. Even though you could say Abraham was unsuccessful in diverting judgment in spite of his long prayer, this act of intercession deepened his understanding of God, didn't it? It demonstrated in a most gracious manner the way in which God wanted to involve Abraham in his purposes. Jesus makes a statement in the Gospel of John, which I think could almost be a New Testament commentary on this incident. Jesus says, I do not call you servants, because a servant doesn't know what his master is doing. I call you friends. There's no other reason, it seems, for God revealing to Abraham his intention to judge Sodom except because Abraham was the friend of God. God would not hide his intention because Abraham was peculiarly his friend. In fact, do you notice in verse 22 of the chapter, there's a marginal alteration if you have an NIV with you. The men turned away and went towards Sodom, but, says the margin, not Abraham remained standing before the Lord, but the Lord remained standing before Abraham. The point seems to have been that the scribes couldn't believe that the author of Genesis had got his sentence the right way round, because as it was, it sounded as if the Lord was waiting for Abraham's initiative, you see. The Lord stood waiting before Abraham. That's not the right way round, they said. No. So they piously amended the text to make Abraham the subject of the verb instead. But I'm quite sure the inspired narrator wrote exactly what he meant. The Lord was indeed waiting for Abraham. He was graciously offering him the opportunity to speak. Friendship demanded it, you see. Demanded that he take this man into his confidence and give him the chance to discuss the whole situation with him. He knew what he was going to do wasn't going to be popular with Abraham. He wanted Abraham to understand the reasons for it and to be satisfied about it. And I think that really is a most wonderful insight into the nature of prayer. Prayer, you know, is much better understood as an act of communion with God, an act of fellowship with God, than as an attempt to make God alter his plans or to inform him of things he didn't know. There's a great encouragement, I think, to us when we find our prayers are unanswered in Abraham's experience here. Maybe you're feeling like that this morning, frustrated. You've been deluging God's throne with petitions about things for a long while, but nothing seems to change. What's the point of praying, you say? Well, in one sense, Abraham's prayer accomplished nothing too. Sodom was still destroyed, wasn't it? Yet in spite of its apparent failure, I don't think there was anything futile about this prayer, do you? On the contrary, it took Abraham up into the heart of God, more closely than perhaps he'd ever been before. That's how it often will be with unanswered prayer. Now, Paul found it so. Three times I besought the Lord, he said, to take away this thorn in the flesh. But he said, no, my grace is sufficient for you. Jesus found it so too. If it be possible, let this cup pass from me. But God said, no, my will is best. And I'm sure we shall find it so too. George MacDonald says in one of his books, the goal of prayer is not to gain what God can give us, but God himself. Is that what you want when you pray? God? Or what God can give you? God invites us to pray to him, you see. Not because he doesn't know his mind, or because he needs our advice. He invites us to pray as he invited Abraham, because he longs for our friendship. But sometimes, of course, when we pray, we have hard things to say to God. And it's precisely that friendship that enables us to say them. Look at Abraham's complaint again in verse 23. Will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of 50? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do right? Abraham's speaking for us all there, isn't he? Every time we see pictures of disaster, like that King's Cross Underground fire recently, we feel we want to make the same protest to God. God, how can you be so indiscriminate? Sweeping people away without regard to their individual merits. Would you destroy the righteous and the wicked? God, how can you be so inconsistent? Such behavior doesn't fit what we know of your character. Shouldn't the judge of all the earth do right? We can't attribute such incidents to you, Lord. We must find some other explanation. Will not the judge of all the earth do right? But that's precisely the point, isn't it? Abraham must learn what the rightness of God's action is all about. He must learn that what God planned to do in Sodom was indeed righteous. That his righteousness was not being compromised by what he was planning to do. Quite the opposite. His righteousness and justice would have been compromised to allow Sodom to go on the way it was going without judging it. The judge of all the earth must do right. Our problem is that our perception of what is right is so often warped. Warped by moral indifference, sometimes. Most of us can read about the most appalling crimes in our newspapers and barely it raises a flicker of shock of indignation in us. God, on the other hand, is revolted at the very depths of his holiness by such things. The degree of moral horror and anger that arises within him when he sees evil is unimaginable to us. Our judgment, too, is so often warped by ignorance, isn't it? For many of us live in a fool's paradise. We have no idea of just how serious the problem of human sin is, how far evil has penetrated into our culture. Just how widespread the corruption goes. We've no idea how tiny the residue of righteousness within the human race has become. God, on the other hand, is under no illusions about those terrible statistics. He knows all too well. But supremely, I fear, when it comes to God's judgments, our ideas of right are warped by sentimentality. For if we're honest, most of us find our emotions are more sensitive than our consciences. We find the prospect of human suffering and pain more traumatic than we find the prospect of human sin and evil. And God, on the other hand, sees things the other way round. For him, evil is a far greater problem than pain. That's why he's able to contemplate the judgment of Sodom. Indeed, that is why he's able to contemplate the agony of Calvary. Because for God, sin hurts more than wounds. We can't make sense, then, of that which is most glaring and obvious to God. We're prejudiced. Prejudiced by our indifference, by our ignorance, by the sentimentality of our fallen natures.
Yes, Abraham, the judge of all the earth, will do right. But sometimes the only way we human beings can convince ourselves of his justice is by wrestling with him in prayer about it. Till at last, through interaction with him, our indifference and our ignorance and our sentimentality is dissolved and reshaped. And at last we begin to see things from his divine point of view. When we do begin to see divine judgment that way, then like Abraham, maybe we will discover three important things. Let me just point them out to you. They emerge so clearly from this prayer he has with God. The first thing that will be made clear to us, I think, as we wrestle with God in prayer about his acts of judgment in the world, is that God does judge societies and that he has every right to do so. The prophet Amos, centuries later, could ask, does disaster come to a city and I, the Lord, have not caused it? I know historians may look for economic and political explanations for the rise and fall of nations and so on, but the Bible insists that the real explanation is moral and spiritual. Behind this universe, there is a sovereign who is possessed of an intense ethical awareness. God loves righteousness, and he hates evil. And the Bible does not use those words love and hate carelessly. The Lord of history is passionate about morality. He has destroyed worlds for the sake of that passion. And the Bible insists he will destroy this world again. For the same reason, for the sake of the same passion. Every disaster that befalls our human society is both a warning and a premonition of that final judgment born of the divine passion for righteousness. Make no mistake about it, the God who judged Sodom 2 millennia ago, or 2 millennia before Christ, he will judge Britain 2 millennia after him. And his divine righteousness will be no more impugned by his judgment of us than it was by his judgment of Sodom. This is the kind of God we have to deal with. If we don't like it, well, we can protest. But we cannot change him from the sort of God he is. The second thing we learn, if we engage in prayer, as Abraham did with God, about these disasters that befall our world, is that the presence of God's people in a culture make a difference. Now, it doesn't matter how you interpret this bargaining exchange in which Abraham engages with God. A clear implication of it has to be that God does take note of the righteous within a society. And they can have a beneficial influence on that society, out of all proportion to their numerical strength. I know it may have been a hypothetical question, but we must surely assume that God is telling the truth when he says that he could have spared Sodom for the sake of just 10 uncorrupted individuals. Perhaps that's part of what Jesus meant when he called his disciples the salt of the earth. One of the things salt does is to preserve, doesn't it? You don't need a lot of salt. A little sprinkling will preserve something. Without you, he's saying there, perhaps, human civilization would be a lost cause. Without the presence of the church, judgment would be inevitable. It's an encouraging thought, that, isn't it? We don't have to be a moral majority, you know. A moral minority is quite enough. God can still pardon a people if he has a moral minority on his side. And the third lesson we learn here is that God does distinguish between righteous and unrighteous individuals in his judgments. It's not true to say that God sweeps away the righteous and the wicked indiscriminately. It may look like that superficially. No one can dispute the reality of innocent suffering in this world. Jesus himself insisted that people who perish in natural disasters aren't necessarily worse sinners than anybody else. No, he knew better than anybody what innocent suffering was all about. But the point is this, looked at from the perspective of eternity, God does preserve his own. That's the assurance the Bible gives us. He may not preserve their society, he may not preserve their culture. Things may have gone too far for that, as they had in Sodom. but he will save them out of the judgment he inflicts. Just as he saved Noah out of the flood, just as he saved Lot out of Sodom. But for some of us, it may be a narrow escape. Let's look at that escape now in the second movement as we switch to camera number 2 in Sodom and chapter 19. The two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. "My lords," he said, "please turn aside to your servants' house. You can wash your feet and spend the night and then go on your way early in the morning." "No," they answered, "we will spend the night in the square." But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him and entered his house, and he prepared a meal for them. Now, we who are on the inside knowledge of the conversation with Abraham have a sense of grim foreboding, don't we, as we switch to this number 2 camera and see what is going on 50 miles away in Sodom. 10 righteous people doesn't seem a lot, but it would nevertheless be more than Sodom could muster. And no sooner have the angelic visitors arrived in Lot's home than a situation develops which amply proves the point. At verse 4. "Before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They called to Lot, 'Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them.'" The word translated there in verse 5, "to have sex with them," is the Hebrew verb to know. And some rather optimistic commentators have sought to deny any implication of sexual perversion in this verse by exploiting that ambiguity. The men of Sodom, they suggest, were angry with Lot for bringing in 2 potential spies into the city. They simply wanted to find out who they were. They wanted to establish their bona fides. They wanted to know them. Well, less offensive though that interpretation of the passage may be, I really don't think it holds much water, do you? And if the intention of the Sodomites were so innocuous, why on earth does Lot go on as he does in verses 6 to 8? "Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, 'No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have 2 daughters who've never slept known a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you like with them, but don't do anything to these men, for they've come under the protection of my roof.'" Well, that is a sop to lust, not to ignorance, isn't it? It's quite clear what these men of Sodom were planning. It was homosexual rape, and Lot knew it. Perhaps he regularly stationed himself at the gate of the city and prevailed upon travellers to stay in his house overnight, precisely because he knew what danger they could be in if they sought accommodation anywhere else in the town. But it has to be said, too, that if he seriously regarded the rape of his own daughters as a preferable, lesser evil, well then, frankly, his own moral judgment was only marginally less twisted than those of the rest of the men in the town. Now, what we see revealed here, you see, as we have seen it actually before, those of you who were here last week, is a streak of weakness in this man Lot. He knew the difference between right and wrong, but he didn't have the moral backbone necessary to make a firm stand on an issue of right and wrong. I suspect he was one of those anything for a quiet life type of men, you know. He didn't like what was going on in Sodom, but he was much too much of a coward to make a fuss about it. Compromise had been his tactic ever since he'd gone to live there. And now he's faced with a mob at the door. Compromise is the only thing he can think of.
Offering them fornication in exchange for perversion. Heterosexual rape as an alternative to homosexual rape. Not surprising that the lecherous citizens of Sodom did not find his moralistic protests much of a deterrent. Verse 9. "Get out of our way," they replied. "This fellow came here as an alien. Now he wants to play the judge. We'll treat you worse than them," they said. Intimidated and ineffective, Lot is hauled back inside by the angelic visitors he's entertaining. They know it's time now for them to take matters into their own hands. "Quick," they say, "the Lord intends to destroy this moral cesspit of a place. Get yourself and your family together and leave before it's too late." Lot is aghast. He'd learned enough about God during his years with Abraham, his uncle, to know this was no idle threat. Urgently, we read, he summons his sons-in-law and tells them of the imminent danger they're all in. But tragically, it seems that they have as little respect for Lot as the rest of the men of the city. Verse 14. Hurry and get out of this place, he says. The Lord is about to destroy the city. But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. Paul the Alleleg dad, they mocked. You don't expect us to take that kind of hellfire and damnation talk seriously, do you? I mean, your puritanical childhood is at last made you flip your lid, dad. So some of the lads got a bit overexcited. Doesn't follow the end of the world is nigh, you know. And by the sound of it, Lot's words had no greater effect on his wife and daughters. What's come over you, darling? You can't seriously just be suggesting that we emigrate just on the say-so of these two strangers. I mean, what about the double wedding we're planning? For your daughters, next month, you know, we've got the city temple for the service and the guild hall for the reception. What on earth will people think of us? So the debate goes on through the night, and morning comes, and still we find Lot is paralyzed with indecision. Verse 16. He hesitated. The coming of dawn, the angels urge him, hurry, take your wife and your two daughters away here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished. But he hesitates. This is the mark of Lot, isn't it? He knew it had been a mistake to come and live in Sodom all along. He'd had to compromise his conscience again and again and again to go on living there. And even now, with the judgment of God hovering over him, he equivocates. Unable to detach himself from the magnetic spell this urban culture hypnotized him with. He hesitates. So comfortable, you see, so secure living in the big city. He's afraid to stay and he's afraid to leave. Could the place really be in such imminent danger? Contradictory fears collide within him. He vacillates like Macbeth, letting I dare not wait upon I would. Till finally God, in his mercy, makes his decision for him. Verse 16. When he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and of his two daughters and led them safely out of the city. For the Lord was merciful to them. And as soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, flee for your lives, don't look back, and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you'll be swept away. And still this pathetic man can't cope. Oh no, he says, not the mountains, not the wilderness again. I must have four walls around me or I shall die of paranoia. Verse 20. No, my lords, please, your servant has found favor in your eyes and you've shown great kindness to me in sparing my life, but I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me and I'll die. Look, here is a town near enough to run to. It is small. Let me flee to it. It is a very small town, isn't it? So Lot, you see, gets his wish. He exchanged the excitement of the big city for the provincialism of the country town. But as things turn out, he couldn't feel secure anymore, even there. Terrified with thoughts of further seismic catastrophe, we read in verse 30, Lot and his two daughters left Zoar, this little town, and settled in the mountains, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. He and his two daughters lived in a cave. What a place for a companion of Abraham to finish up, a cave. But he had to have a secure environment, you see. His uncle's tents had been too flimsy. He tried city walls, and now they had let him down. It seems nothing man-made could protect him. A cave was the only place where he felt safe. It was just as well Jesus said that faith the size of a grain of mustard seed would do, because that's about all the faith Lot had. What are the lessons then we ought to draw from this narrowest of narrow escapes that he experienced? Well, there are several things I think I must bring your attention from this chapter. The first thing we must take notice of is the sin that brought down this judgment upon Sodom. Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them, they demanded. Now, I've no doubt there are many other signs of moral corruption within this degenerate city. In fact, the prophet Ezekiel speaks of her complacent pride and her self-indulgent affluence and of her indifference toward the plight of the poor and needy. There are many other things
going on in Sodom that merited God's judgment. But it is surely significant that the narrator, in this window which he opens for us upon the life of that city, shows us this spectacle of sexual perversion. And I would be failing in my duty to you if I didn't point out to you the relevance of that for us today. Let me say straight away, I'm appalled by the kind of homophobic hate campaign that some self-righteous people seem to feel it's their duty to engage in against gay men and women. Homosexuals are to be treated with the same love and respect as any other members of the human race. The doors of this church are as open to them as to anybody else. For we're all sinners in need of God's grace. Indeed, if Kinsey was right, then 10% of the male population seated here this morning have homosexual traits in their personality and very possibly homosexual experiences in their background. But it must also be said that homosexual acts are sins. They are sins of a very gross kind. They are sins which were punishable by death in the Old Testament law. And they are sins which, according to the Apostle Paul in his letter to the Romans, are peculiarly the mark of a God-forsaken society. A society which is on the brink of being engulfed by the judicial wrath of God. You may want to reply, oh, but homosexuality has been practiced in Western society for centuries, on the quiet. And no brimstone from heaven has yet fallen as a result. In fact, I readily grant. But you missed the point. In Sodom's case, you see, it was not simply that there were some gay people in the city secretly conducting homosexual affairs in private. The point about Sodom was that this abandonment of God's order for human sexuality was being paraded brazenly in the streets, with the consent and even with the participation of the vast majority of the city's population. See what he says in verse 4. All the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, were in that mob. That's how bad things had got in Sodom. It wasn't just that sexual perversion was being practiced, it was being practiced without shame, without any form of social sanction or control. Indeed, anybody who, like Lot, dared to voice a protest against this immorality, no matter how muted, was scorned as a bigot. He's trying to play judge. Well, dare I point out to you just how close that picture is to our 20th century Western society. It is the brazenness of our sexual permissiveness and perversity which is the hallmark of the 1980s. We're no longer content to do things in private. We must have a public permission to do them. I agree, we haven't seen any lethal brimstone yet. But we have discovered a lethal virus. And in the long run, you know, AIDS is likely to kill 10,000 more people than Sodom's earthquake ever did. Whole populations in this world are going to be decimated by that plague before the end of this century. If we can't see the hand of God's judgment in its arrival, then frankly we are as naive as Lot's sons-in-law were. That's the first thing we must note from this most solemn chapter. The second thing I want to point out to you from this chapter is the uselessness of a compromised testimony. Look again at verse 14. His sons-in-law thought he was joking. In fact, not one person in this whole city willingly followed Lot out of Sodom. His testimony just went for nothing. He had no credibility with his neighbours, he had no credibility with his family. The long-term impact of his life was negative, not positive, as the narrator goes on to point in a very sordid incident right at the end of chapter 19. You'll notice that his daughters, although they do manage to escape with their father, finish up committing incest with him. Well, was it reasonable to expect the daughters raised in Sodom would have a conscience about such things? The indifference he'd shown towards his children's moral education came home to roost with Lot. His testimony had no effect. A worldly parent, he produced worldly children and had no impact at all on his society. Why? It's all summed up in that verse 16, isn't it? He hesitated. That was Lot. There was no real commitment in this man's life. He stands in the Bible as the classic example of the man who sat on the fence, the spiritual mugwump, the man who couldn't make up his mind. He had Abraham's faith, true, but he didn't have Abraham's pilgrimage. He was a believer, but he wasn't a disciple. And as a result, his testimony achieved nothing for God. The reaction of his sons-in-law is in every way typical. They had no respect for him. They'd seen the inconsistency in his life, no doubt. They heard him offering their fiancées to the mob. They know what Lot was like, the kind of two-faced, compromised hypocrite he was. Anybody who genuinely believed there was a prospect of divine judgment on Sodom would never have lived there in the first place, but Lot did. Now, as far as they were concerned, his religion was a big joke. You couldn't take the man seriously. Once again, I'd be failing in my duty to you if I didn't say that the man in the street seems increasingly to be feeling that way about the church in this country. There's been a good deal written in the press recently about the Church of England, hasn't there? It began with the synod's debate about homosexual clergy, appropriately enough, which many newspapers, rightly or wrongly, interpreted as an evidence of moral compromise. And now this week we've seen this stinging attack on Archbishop Runcie in the new edition of Crockford's Clerical Directory. I don't want to get involved in those debates. It would be inappropriate for me to do so. But I do know this, that the church in this country is in grave danger of being useless as a witness to Jesus Christ for precisely the same reason Lot was useless. Because she is a joke. Because she is perceived by men and women in the street to be inconsistent, vacillating about issues on which she ought to be able to speak with more moral authority than anybody else in the country. Whether the synod's decision on gay clergy was a fudge cobbled together by the bishops who knew that a firm line would never win a vote, I don't know. But people believe it is so. The mere fact that the whole issue had to be raised by an insignificant clergyman rather than a bishop himself speaks volumes. And in the same way, Lot was certainly not making a stand against sexual aberration in his city. Whether the criticisms of Archbishop Runcie are true or not, I will not judge. But many people believe they are true. And Lot was certainly a man who, to quote a phrase from that notorious preface to Crockford's Directory, nailed his colours firmly to the fence. For Lot, you see, the result was, though he had a narrow escape himself, he saved nobody else. Even the two daughters were ashamed of him at the end of the day. Isn't there a lesson for the church to learn in Lot? The uselessness of a compromised testimony. Well did Jesus say, if the salt loses its taste, it's good for nothing, and will be thrown out by men and trampled under their feet. That's what the world does to a tasteless, compromised church. It's what the world did to Lot. But there is one final lesson I want you to learn from our study this morning. And that is the vital necessity of a first-hand faith in God. Look at verses 24 and 26. Then the Lord rained down burning sulphur on Sodom and Gomorrah, from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, including all those living in the cities, and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. I suspect this must be the most poignant moment in the entire story, perhaps. I guess she'd always been reluctant to leave, and she delayed a little too long, you see, hankering regretfully after the city of her birth. She almost made it. But in the case of Lot's wife, almost wasn't good enough. What was her problem? Her problem, I suggest, was she had a second-hand relationship to God. She was married to a believer. It was an advantage, no question about it. Had she been married to anybody else, she would never have got as far as she did. But it wasn't enough. Lot's wife stands as an obelisk of warning to us, any of us, who think we may be saved through our Christian family, or our Christian partner, or our Christian connections. We can't. We must have a first-hand trust in God himself if he is going to rescue us in the day of judgment. See, for all his spiritual inadequacy, for all his worldly compromise, for all his moral cowardice, for all his failures, Lot did have a glimmer of genuine faith. He was the seed of Abraham, spiritually as well as physically. So when judgment came, God saved him. Reassuring for some of us here, who perhaps feel there's rather more Lot in us than there is Abraham. But it did not save his wife. Her body belonged to a man of God, but her heart belonged to the world. And when the day of judgment came, it was her heart that betrayed her heart that condemned her, wasn't it? The lesson surely is plain. Don't rely on narrow escapes. Don't be satisfied with a hesitant Christian commitment. Don't be satisfied with a second-hand faith. Make your own calling and election sure. That's the lesson of this passage. She was so close to rescue, you see. But she shows to us that if it is possible to escape judgment by the skin of your teeth, it is also possible to lose salvation by the skin of your teeth. Like Bunyan tells us, there is a way to hell, even from the very gates of heaven. I guess the words of Jesus are comment enough. In the days of Lot, he said, people were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But the day Lot left Sodom, fire and sulphur fell down from heaven and destroyed them all. It will be just like that on the day the Son of Man is revealed. I tell you, two people will be together in one bed. One will be taken, the other left. Remember, he said, remember Lot's wife. Let's pray together.